Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, thank you so much, and Bob, thank you. Without your leadership and the leadership of the board, we would not be where we are. And I also see in the audience our good friend Pat Patterson, who really continues to support the council in so many ways, but served with such distinction as our chairwoman. And when you talk about the educational program, it truly would not have happened without Pat Patterson's encouragement, and I might even say to my friends in this audience, her whip. But thank you very much. We have really been looking forward to your visit, and I think everybody is relatively familiar with your bio. But I suppose the thing you want me to really highlight is your book right now is number 2 on the New York Times combined list, and number 1, did you say, on the e-book list?
Yes, we're a modern book conglomerate. We like people who will buy the electronic version.
Well, you know, without any doubt, the book will stay there with the folks here because, as I promised your publisher, they are indeed readers. And in just a few weeks, we have Christmas, so it's time to not do, as Larry Sabato said when he was here, and he said, don't just buy one book, but buy one for your brothers and your sisters and everybody else you know.
I was actually promised that everyone here was buying multiple books, and so I'm going to hold you all to that.
But I think many of us here, because I saw a large number of people came in with Game Change, and we all enjoyed that. And I have to tell you, my wife, Terrell, and I were just waiting for this book to come out. John is also a political analyst with MSNBC and has written a number of articles when he was with, we never saw the byline, but he was with the chief Washington correspondent and media correspondent for The Economist. So we are delighted to have you with us. So again, welcome. You know, the media, when your book first came out, they really focused on a few highlights. And I think let's just get those sort of out of the way in case some of the folks here missed them. And two of them were, you know, what was the consideration to dumping Joe Biden, Uncle Joe, as he was affectionately called. And then let's also talk about the clouds that may encircle Governor Christie.
I'm happy to talk about both those things, but I'm going to talk about something else first because I had a moment of enormous pride. We both did, Mark and I, in the last couple days. You know, you're always looking for endorsements, you know, for your book, and people say nice things and write reviews occasionally. We had the extraordinary pleasure yesterday of being endorsed by the person you always want to be endorsed by when you write a book. And that is North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Uh-huh. I'm not kidding. Yesterday there was a story.
Me and Dennis Rodman were reading the book together.
We were down in Austin, Texas yesterday. Texas, as if I had to say that. We were down in Austin yesterday, and as we were about to do an event at the LBJ Library, a news alert came over my email, and it had this reference to the Kim Jong-un book club. Who knew there was a North Korean book club? But there was a story in the Washington Post, and this to me is like going straight onto the back of the paperback. The headline of the story is, North Korea endorses double down as proof that, quote, the U.S. is the root cause of all sorts of evils. I gotta say, it doesn't really get any better than that. Thank you guys all for coming out, and it's a pleasure to be here. I love the state of Texas, and I don't get to Dallas nearly enough, and I'm really grateful that you guys invited me to come. This is an august group. I know we're going to talk for a little bit, and then
yeah,
we're
open
do,
it up,
and then we're going to do Q&A. I'll happy to talk about anything you guys want to hear about in Q&A. You can ask about the details of the implementation of the president's healthcare plan, or the details of the Clintons' marriage, whatever interests you more. The only rule I will enforce in the Q&A is that all questions need to be formulated in the form of true/false. It makes it easier for me. The first two questions were about Biden and Hillary, right? And Chris Christie. Let me try to do those as quickly as I can.
We're going to come back to Hillary, but do Biden. Yeah, well, Biden.
Yes, we would love to. I'd love to talk about the Clintons always. The thing we reported in the book about Joe Biden was, and there have been a million stories about this now, and almost all of them, and I say this with due respect to my colleagues in the media, many of them are wrong, especially headlines that say things like, Joe Biden was almost ousted from the ticket, Barack Obama almost dumped Joe Biden. That's not what we had. What we wrote in the book. The New York Times, which reported about it first, actually had it right, which was, and it really is an important story in some sense, even though it never came to fruition. In the fall of 2011, when the president was at his low ebb politically, his approval ratings down around 40%, and two-thirds of the country saying the country was on the wrong track, the economy obviously in a bad place still, unemployment over 8%, GDP growth meager at best, the president's team had come to the conclusion at that point that he was at no better than a 50-50 chance of winning re-election. Many of them thought that he was an underdog at that point. The president's quote to one of his top advisors when he was asked what he thought of his prospects, he said, I think I'm in deep shit. So the team around Obama, in a very close hold way, a very small group of people, led by Chief of Staff Bill Daley, who is probably the closest person in the White House to Joe Biden, very good friends for many, many years. Bill Daley had been the person who ran Joe Biden's presidential campaign in 1988. That's how good of friends they were. But because of Daley's sense of how acute the president's political situation was, his dilemma, he thought it would be professional malpractice not to explore the possibility of what it would mean if Hillary Clinton were to be switched onto the put on the ticket and Joe Biden were to be replaced. There were almost nobody around the president who knew about this. There were only a handful of people: David Axelrod, the senior campaign advisor; David Plouffe, the senior advisor in the White House; Bill Daley, the head of polling; a guy named Joel Benenson. And they had to be very careful about it because they were afraid that if they polled it, if they researched it in the most obvious ways, the word would get out, and they didn't want that word to get out. There had been a lot of speculation about the possibility of Biden being switched with Hillary, which had been denied constantly for 3 years by the White House. But in fact, they went out and spent a lot of money, or a fair amount of money, not by their standards a lot of money, given it was a $1 billion campaign, but a reasonable amount of money to test the proposition with voters in various subtle ways to try to ask the question, to try to kind of nose around the issue. And what they found when they did polling and focus groups was that Hillary Clinton did not materially improve the president's odds. And so they were able to then look at that and say, well, you know, there were always downsides, right? And they all had this attitude, which was, we like Joe Biden, but we have to look at this. But it would look weak and desperate if we switch, and so there's a cost to that. She would obviously inject a certain amount of excitement on the ticket, and she's very strong with certain constituencies, so there'd be an advantage. But as I say, when they did the research, and this was a group that really believed that being hard-headed was better than being soft-hearted at any given moment, the president seems very hard-boiled. And as I say, their notion was they had to do this due diligence.
Was she sounded out at all about this?
She did, to the best of my knowledge, she did not know that the polling took place. I'm certain that Joe Biden did not know that any of it took place. Biden had been very bothered by even the speculation over the course of years that he might be replaced. And so they kept this all very, very quiet. And I guess it goes to two things. The reason it's relevant in some sense, other than the fact that it's a fact that they tried to conceal for a long time, is just how bad they thought the president's standing was, that they were willing to even consider doing this. And secondly, the extent to which the Obama team really, all of them love Joe Biden, and Bill Daley leading among them, really cherish the vice president as a person, but they are cold-blooded killers in a lot of ways. And their attitude was, you know, this re-election, just like Barack Obama's election in 2008, is about Barack Obama. And much of the tension in the White House that existed, and we can talk more about this if you want, between the Biden camp, Biden world, and Obama world was exactly along those lines. Joe Biden wanted to be a partner with Barack Obama. He wanted to be the Obama-Biden ticket. Most of Barack Obama's people, if they could outlaw the vice presidency and just, you know, constitutionally take it out, their attitude was it's just only problems. And it's nothing to do with Joe Biden, although he caused some problems. It's just to do with, you know, they think of Barack Obama as a one-man show. And their attitude was, you know, if this may seem ruthless, but we're going to have to do it. So that's the first one, right? Mm-hmm. Second one has to do with Chris Christie. And what a big man he is in so many ways. It's the president's remark about Chris Christie after touring an earlier storm, not Sandy, but after going up to New Jersey for an earlier hurricane, came back to the White House, and when his colleagues asked, you know, what did you think of Governor Christie? He said, he's a big, big man.
And Mitt Romney said that a lot too.
And he did. And I'm not taking a shot at him. I mean, he's a big personality. He's a big physical presence. He's just a big, big character. He's a big character in the book. The relationship between the Romney campaign and the Christie campaign, again, we could talk about this in more detail if you want, was difficult from the beginning to the end. But in the middle of the summer of 2012, Governor Romney decided he was about to start doing his vice presidential search. We report in the book about how his team of vetters, that's vetting is what it's called when you look into a vice president's potential vice presidential nominee's background, his team of vetters, it was a very, again, a very secretive process, as it often is, more so this time than in probably any year in the, any cycle in the past, partly because of the exposure that the vetting of Sarah Palin got in the course of the last cycle because of game change. They were very worried about leaks, and so the team of vetters thought they needed to communicate in code about the five people who made the shortlist. So they came up with a very clever code names for the five candidates. The five final candidates were Governor Christie, Senator Rubio from Florida, Senator Portman, Rob Portman from Ohio, former Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, and the fifth that's now flying out of my mind, of course, the guy who actually got it, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin. Those were the five, right? So they came up with clever code names for each of them. They called Senator Portman. The idea, the conceit of the code names was these guys spent a lot of time up late eating junk food. So they looked up one day and saw a bag of goldfish crackers sitting on the desk. And they thought, oh, we'll give them all aquatic code names. We'll name them after fish. So Governor Pawlenty was called Lakefish because he's from the land of a thousand lakes, right? And Senator Portman, a very bland fellow from Ohio, was named Filet-O Fish. They called Senator Rubio, they called him Pescado. Governor Ryan, or Congressman Ryan, a very, very clever, super secret name, like the NSA would never have cracked this one, they called him Fish Sconson. and when they got to Governor Christie, they called him Puffer Fish. So that gives you some sense of how Governor Christie was regarded in Romney's world. And they started to look into his background, and there were a bunch of things in Governor Christie's in what they would refer to as the public record, things that if you didn't need to ask for information from Governor Christie about these things, you could find them if you knew where to look. So if I gave you the right Google terms, you could find these things, but they're not really that well known. In fact, I'll give you one example, which almost no one in this room will know is true, even though, again, you could find it in Google if you looked. Most of you probably don't know Governor Christie was ever a lobbyist, right? That's not a well-known fact, but he was a lobbyist for a period of time. And during the period that he was a lobbyist, he lobbied for the Securities Industry Association of America. It, at the time, had one goal. Its goal was to exclude financial fraud from the New Jersey State Consumer Protection Law. And that's, you know, a little bit problematic, but more problematic was the person who was the head of the SIAA then, which is a guy named Bernie Madoff. You may have heard of him. And I do mean that Bernie Madoff, not some other Bernie Madoff. So Governor, again, not widely known to national reporters or most people in national politics, Governor Romney's people looked at that and thought, you know, Mitt Romney with his Wall Street connections, if he put Governor Christie on the ticket, there would be an immediate 30-second ad that would get made. Governor Romney has just named Bernie Madoff's lobbyist to the vice presidential slot. It's not like a great political problem to have. There were a variety of things like that. And government investigations by the Justice Department into Governor Christie's time when he was a state's attorney in New Jersey, a defamation lawsuit that was filed against him. Governor Christie's brother was involved in a securities scandal that involved a settlement with the SEC. A variety of things that were on the public record, not widely known, all sort of potential unexploded landmines. There was another series of issues where they asked Governor Christie to provide a lot of information, as you do when you go through vetting. I've never seen this before. Mark and I have covered presidential politics each for 20 some years. There's never been a candidate that I know of that agrees to be vetted and then doesn't agree to give over the information that they're asked to turn in. So Governor Romney's people said, you know, we need to know about your health records, for instance. We need to, you know, you're morbidly obese. We need to know, like, what kind of health you're in. Governor Christie was reluctant and did not turn over all of the information that they wanted. They wanted to know more about his other lobbying clients. He didn't give them that information. They wanted to know more about his household help and more about his brother's lawsuit with the SEC. Governor Christie held back a lot of that information, and Governor Romney's chief vetting officer, Beth Myers, who was his chief of staff when he was in the State House in Massachusetts. Who has some Dallas roots. Beth Myers said, you know, if he's not giving us answers, we have to assume the answers are bad. So the combination of the things they could find out, coupled with the things that they couldn't find out because Governor Christie was not playing ball, led Governor Romney to ultimately look at this long vetting report, which we quote from in the book, something I don't think anybody's ever done before, long passages of what they thought was problematic about him. And they decided that Governor Romney looked at it and at that point pulled the plug and went into the pool with Fish Sconson. The question that comes up, and I think your question is like, how bad is it? Mm-hmm. It's really, there's not one thing that we currently know of, that I know of, in the record that is a smoking gun,
right?
But there are two different issues. One is, and this is something Governor Romney, in a relatively rare display of good political instincts, really got, which was a number of people around him said, well, you know, these issues that are in the public record, they've all been vetted in New Jersey. They all came up in his governor's race in 2009. And Governor Romney said, governor's race in New Jersey, what are you talking about? Like, that there's nothing that gets vetted at a state level. I've run for governor of Massachusetts. When you step onto the national stage, there's a whole different level of scrutiny. And if you think about things like Whitewater, not a big deal in Arkansas until Bill Clinton ran for national office. George W. Bush's DWI, not a big deal until he ran for national office. Reverend Wright in Chicago, not a big deal for Barack Obama until he ran for national office. These things that lurk in the background in the public record can become very big deals when they become scrutinized as they are by the national media. And then the other question is the question of how Governor Christie handles those things. Mm-hmm. Independently of the individual pieces that are potentially damning, the question is going to go to his temperament. How well does he handle the questions and the scrutiny? And he has been very forthright in the last few days in saying, I understand I'm going to get more scrutiny, but he is a guy who has a fiery
and a fairly large ego.
One of the reasons that he was excluded, that he was dropped from vice presidential consideration, was not that he was too humble. That was not considered a political problem for Governor.
And
Christie.
Romney was really sort of turned off by that attitude.
You know, they had, again, Romney personally and Christie got along fine, although there were things that got between them at times. But, you know, it was really, there was a diva-like quality that Boston, the Romney, like, high command saw in Governor Christie. He did a ton for Governor Romney once he endorsed him, raised a lot of money for him, traveled all over the country for him. And if Governor Christie were here, he would say, I did everything that I was asked to do. If the people from Boston were here, they would say, well, yes, but you did it in a style that no other surrogate did. You demanded private planes, and you flew around with large presidential size entourages. And most annoyingly to Governor Romney and to some of his people, he had this propensity of showing up late to events. And, you know, there were events that he showed up really late to, and so he would be the headliner at a fundraiser for Governor Romney. And Chris Christie would be late, to the point where Governor Romney, feeling like he was wanted to be punctual and wanted to get the show on the road, Governor Romney would speak first. And then Chris Christie would show up, and it was as if Governor Romney was the warm-up act for Chris Christie. Chris Christie would then come in and wow the room, and it was kind of like, well, who's really the nominee here? Those were all things that bothered me.
But then Governor Romney was a little bit, I guess, or at least the campaign was Boston after the hurricane.
And yes, particularly upset about that. Yep. Yes, and again, one of those things that in real time, Governor Romney's people were, you know, oh, no, it's fine, we understand, he needs to do what he needs to do. And there's no doubt that as the governor of a storm-affected state, everyone had a lot of tolerance for the notion that Governor Christie had to be in good stead with President Obama. But there were many who thought that him going on television day after day and praising President Obama at that point in the campaign was overkill. One of the people who was senior Romney advisor, who we make reference to in the book, saw Christie hugging Obama on the front page of one of the New York newspapers and went on to say that the problem wasn't that Christie hugged Obama, it was that he gave him a French kiss.
Used the word real time, and one of the questions I wanted to ask is, tell us about your methodology, because you and Mark get such access. What are the ground rules that are established between you and the campaign? There's only two of you, but you're covering all the campaigns. How do you go about doing that?
You know, we started on this book later, or earlier than the last book. In the last book, we started in the spring of 2008. And we worked basically for about a year and a half and then published the book. This year, this book, we started much further out. So we're really on this thing for almost 3 years. We both have day jobs that take up a lot of our time at our magazines and on television. So the amount, we're constantly following the campaign as it's progressing. The kinds of interviews that we do, and one of there's no secret sauce to what we do, but one of the things that is essential is that we interview a lot of people. And so for this book, we did more than 500 interviews with more than 400 people, and almost all those interviews are long interviews. They're not phoners. We sit with people often for 2, 3, 4 hours at a time and really just kind of sit down and in the first instance just sort of say, talk to us about your experience in the campaign, and we go through chronologically and talk to people about
it. So this is after the campaign?
Well, I'll just say that the interviews, I'll get to that in a sec. The interviews are long, right? One of the consequences of doing long oral history style interviews with people is that doing things with people while they're in the heat of battle many people do not have time to send those kind, that kind, the kind of time required with us, right? So, you know, the big batches of the interviews we do are sort of after the nomination fights are over, right? In this case, the Republican nomination fight. So in the summer of 2012, we did a ton of reporting on the Republican nomination fight, largely with campaigns that were now over, because the people who had been in those campaigns now had time to be able to do the kind of interviews that we do with people, and their campaigns were over, and so they were able to look back. We think it's really crucial to talk to people as soon as possible after the fact, because so much of what they, of what people remember about these campaigns would be lost, really, to history in some ways if you didn't get them fairly soon. We talk to people 6 months, you know, we'll talk to someone in April and they'll tell us something, and 4 or 5 months later they don't remember that they even told us that thing. That's how bad people's memories are. And so we talked to, we spent a lot of time in the summer of 2012. I mean, we had done some interviews before that, but a huge number that summer and then a huge number after Election Day. And I'd say, I couldn't do a statistical analysis of it, but the vast bulk of the reporting that we do are in one of those two phases. We are, you know, if you read the author's note in the book, in both books we've done the same thing, which is, you know, we have all of our conversations are, to the extent that they're happening in real time with the campaign, they're embargoed until after Election Day. So we say, nothing that you talk to us about now will appear anywhere other than in the book and then after the election's over. And we do all of our interviews on deep background, which means that we apply our same customary reportorial standards. And in a book like this that's written in the omniscient voice, that's written kind of like the voice of God, this happened, this didn't happen, you know, there's not so-and-so said and so-and-so, the other person said, and there are conflicting accounts. We have to get to the point where we feel like we can write definitively, this happened in a room.
So how do you reconcile the conflicting reports that you might get?
Well, if the reports are significantly conflicting enough, we just don't write about the event. But as it turns out, if you spend enough time and you interview everyone in a room or everyone in a conversation, and you spend enough time with them, you go back to them again and again, and you find the places where there are inconsistencies and go back and keep asking people questions over and over again, you can often, almost always, it turns out, come to something that looks like consensus. And like I say, when we come to places where there are radical disjunctures, where the people who are saying, one person says it was black and the other person says it was white, if we can't get to the point where we feel like we're confident that we know what actually happened, we'll just leave that entire thing out. The scrutiny these books get is very high. And people really study them, and we're, because we do the books in the omniscient voice, we're kind of putting our credibility on the line with everything we write. And
so, I can imagine a lot of people at Cramer's quickly looking at the index.
Yes, it's very the Washington Reed. Somebody was talking about Game Change last night, and I pointed out that in the first book, it's too early with this book to know, to make any definitive statements about this. In the first book, there was really only one person who challenged anything factual in the book, and that was Liz Cheney. We had reported in the book that Vice President Cheney's reaction to the selection of Sarah Palin as vice president, that he called it a reckless choice. And after the book came out, Liz Cheney came out and categorically denied it, said absolutely untrue, my father would never have said that, never, 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 did not say it, these guys are totally wrong. And we knew it was right. And then about 3 years later, Vice President Cheney was doing a television interview, and he was asked, what did you think of the selection of Sarah Palin as vice president? He said, I thought it was a reckless choice. So we felt good about that.
One of the things that surprised me, because John Huntsman came across as such an affable, nice person, he's got a mean streak. And he and the relationship he had with Mitt Romney, I guess Utah's not a big enough state for two powerful Mormons, is what I thought.
It's an incredibly fascinating story. They're both you know, members of two of the genuinely great families in the history of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. Epic, you know, founding families that helped build the church, and both have played a huge role in its development. You know, Governor Huntsman's father is an industrialist who at one point was the richest Mormon in the world. Governor Romney's family have high elders in the Mormon church, and the families were entwined for many generations and were very close. And then the two of them came to blows, metaphorically, mm-hmm. over two successive events, one of which was which of them, John Huntsman Jr. or Mitt Romney, would be chosen to be the savior of the Salt Lake Olympics, the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake. Governor Romney got that plum. Governor Huntsman was unhappy about how it happened. Then 4 years after that, when Governor Romney ran for president in 2008, John Huntsman promised Mitt Romney that he would endorse him and then turned around and endorsed Senator McCain, which caused a huge rupture between kind of like drove the stake. It was like one, the first one kind of built the coffin, the second one drove the kind of nail in the coffin. And the two of them really got under each other's skins in a way that neither, there was no one else who got under the skins of each of them the way that they did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Governor Huntsman, a lot of us expected him to be a much stronger candidate than he was, but if you read the book, it's really one of the strangest tales, the story of how he plotted to come back, having been named Barack Obama's ambassador to China, how he planned to come back from Beijing, organized a sort of shadow campaign from, you know, 8,000 miles away, run by a bunch of very, very hard-nosed Republican operatives who, while Governor Huntsman, when he came back, swore to the world that he wanted to run an uplifting, civil, clean hands campaign. His campaign was as merciless and ruthless about destroying his rivals as any other campaign.
I think you had here, any bullet left in the chamber is a bullet wasted.
That was their attitude. And so people remember that when Governor Daniels of Indiana was considering running for president, at the moment when he was trying to decide, there was information that got leaked to the press about his divorce to his current wife, who he had previously divorced and then remarried. That all that information came from the Huntsman campaign. Later on, when Herman Cain was at the top of the polls for that brief moment, before sexual harassment allegations took him down, it was the Huntsman campaign that leaked the sexual harassment allegations to the press also. So they were, and then later on, we report in the book about how John Huntsman Sr., according to Majority Leader Reid, was the source for Harry Reid's claim that Mitt Romney had never paid taxes for 10 years. So there's a lot of Huntsman mischief going on. He's not a very effective candidate, but his team was very effective in taking down others.
Well, speaking about a candidate who was not very effective on the national stage, it's our good governor. You know, I've heard from
a lot. Don't you think he looks great in these new glasses?
He looks great.
I never thought I would see any comparison between Governor Perry and Rachel Maddow, but they really they kind of have the same look going now.
What do you think really happened? Was it the back surgery? Was he not prepared? Was he on painkillers and had a glass of wine? What happened in Michigan?
You know, we report about this. You know, there's, you know, to people who are interested in Governor Perry, which we were certainly were. Mark and I both thought he would be a much stronger candidate than he was. We report about the troubles that he had in this book, and there's some news in the book, not earth-shattering news, but it's a quite interesting news in the sense that, yes, I think the lateness of his entry was itself just massively problematic. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to start a presidential campaign from a standing start in August of the year before. And he really had done, laid no groundwork, had done nothing. And when he started in August, he had a very small team of advisors and had no national organization whatsoever, had no fundraising apparatus, had nothing set in place. That would have been problematic on its own. The fact that he decided to launch his campaign and 6 weeks prior to that have back surgery was, the fact that his people around him let him do that is something close to political malpractice. They didn't really know what the surgery entailed. They didn't know it was an experimental surgery. They didn't know that it involved using adult stem cells, that it was non-FDA approved practice. There was a lot of things about the surgery that they would later find out that if they had known earlier, they would have been, and they should have really asked, they would have been, I think, more cautious about. Governor Perry had the back surgery, and he thought, he confidently said to people, he'd be back at full strength within 2 weeks. Which again, to anybody in this room who knows anything about back problems or has had back surgery, that on its face is kind of a ludicrous thing. Yeah. The surgery did not, it went wrong.
That's what the doctors tell you before you have the surgery.
Yes, exactly right. and you know how the level of trust you should have with a doctor, especially one with a scalpel in his hand. The surgery did not go the way it was supposed to go. I mean, it went the way it was supposed to go, but there were side effects. And they included a pain, numbness and tingling in first one leg, then the other leg, then all the way up one side of him and into his arm. And the problem with all of that was he was uncomfortable. He was not on painkillers for very long, but the problem was that it kept him from running. And one of the things that truly one of the most like kind of human stories in the book, Governor Perry is an insomniac and has been an insomniac his whole life. And in his 20s, when he was in Texas, in Austin, and I think just hanging around the legislature, he had a roommate who suggested to him that he could solve his insomnia problem by taking up running. And so he became addicted to running. He runs every day, and he will tell people that it's the only addiction he has in his life, but he's addicted to running because it lets him sleep. It's the only way he can sleep. And so when the surgery had these bad side effects, he was unable to run. And when he was unable to run, he was unable to sleep. And the fact that he was unable to sleep at the moment when his campaign was taking off is a massive problem. It's the most physically, emotionally, psychologically, intellectually demanding thing you can do in your life is run for president. And to do it on no sleep is brutal. Anyone here who's ever had to go without sleep for a couple days and try to perform at their top level knows, it's like, can imagine how horrible it was. He tried everything. He tried warm baths, didn't work. He tried Lyrica, didn't work. He checked himself secretly into a sleep clinic in Austin to find out if he had apnea. He was diagnosed with having apnea, given a sleep mask and a sleep machine, which he used during the early part of the campaign, had no effect whatsoever. He could not sleep. And in the midst of all of his running around, trying to raise money because he was starting so late, with a punishing schedule, the fact that he was unable to sleep made him, I think, very close to delirious much of the time. And he was doing these debates where he failed miserably as a candidate, operating on essentially no sleep for weeks on end. I mean, he basically did not get a good night's sleep or anything close to a full night's sleep for the first 3 months of the campaign. And it may be that he would have been a bad candidate even without that problem. But with that problem, I don't know if there's anybody who could have performed at a high level.
You've reported that, but he really has never talked about it, has he?
He has not talked about it publicly. And
do you think that's something that he should do?
I've been a little surprised that no one has asked him about it since the book has come out. But I'm 100% confident that the account in the book is correct. And I think, you know, he now is in better shape. And I think he's not troubled by this problem anymore. And I think it's part of the thing that gives him some degree of confidence that he'll do better if he runs in 2016, which I think he probably will. He thinks, you know, he's learned a lot about having gone through the process once. There are a lot of Republicans and a lot of candidates on the other side as well who run once and fail and then do better the next time around. Right. And I think the combination of his sense that he now understands the process better and that he would be starting not so late and that he doesn't have this physical issue anymore, I think is part of what's fueling his sense of openness to, at a minimum, openness to thinking about running again.
Before we open it up, let me anticipate what I think will be one of the questions, and that is about Citizens United and the role of big money. Newt Gingrich was able to stay in the campaign because $5 million was put in by the Las Vegas developer, Sheldon
Adelson.
Addison.
Yep.
The question is, what is the role of big money, and do you see any way that it's ever going to change?
I do not see any way that it's ever going to change. I think, you know, we're now, so there's a lot of different ways to answer this question. Put aside all the questions just for the moment, I mean, we can talk about them as much as anybody wants to, the questions of, is it pernicious, is it bad, is it corrupting, all that stuff. Huge important questions, and I don't mean to in any way diminish them. Just at a purely practical level, politically, you know, we are now in this post-Citizens United era. We had a $2 billion presidential campaign in 2012. There's no reason that I see that we're going to be in a campaign in 2016 that's going to have less money in it than there was last time. The role of money in this race was mixed, as you said. There's no question that both Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum would not have been able to continue their campaigns as long as they did and elongate the process as much as they did if they hadn't had billionaire sugar daddies who were willing to spend the kind of money they were. The Romney campaign was aided enormously by its super PAC, its primary super PAC, Restore Our Future, which really incinerated Newt Gingrich on two successive occasions. And you feel bad in some ways for Newt Gingrich as much as he provided us with a lot of comedy in this book. You know, you feel bad for him, a man who was once the Speaker of the House and ends his one presidential campaign by being bitten by a penguin. It's a kind of tragicomic kind of arc. But they did a lot of strategically useful work for Romney. Mm-hmm. In the general election, you know, the Republican advantage in super PAC spending yielded really apparently no result whatsoever. Whereas on the Democratic side, the one small super PAC the president had working for him actually seems to have done some real damage to Mitt Romney in some swing states because they were running a very well orchestrated ad campaign that built very much on the president's messaging, and they were very, very, very targeted and very, very, very targeted, very surgical about where they spent money, and they seem to have moved the needle in those places. Going forward, you know, I think the question of who is a viable candidate in either party. If you are not a candidate who can demonstrate to the party that you're running in that you'll be able to readily raise $1 billion or more, in the combination of regular money and super PAC money, I think it will be very hard to be taken seriously in that context. And part of the reason why Hillary Clinton is formidable on the Democratic side is because she can. Yeah. And part of the reason why people like Chris Christie and people like Jeb Bush and a handful of other people on the Republican side will be seen immediately as competitive by the filter, the media filter, and by their parties is that they will ostensibly be able to muster the financial backing that will allow them to go toe-to-toe with Secretary Clinton if she, assuming that she runs. I can't imagine a candidate who doesn't demonstrate that being taken seriously, again, by the arbiters of such things in the press and the national parties.
We've barely scratched the surface, but I want to open it up to our members. We haven't talked about the debates and, of course, whether or not Hillary, of course, she's going to run. But questions? Now, this isn't, Robert, yep.
I'd like to fast forward to 2016 for a moment, and assuming Hillary does win, does run and win, what role do you see for Bill Clinton in the campaign and as the wife, as the husband of the president?
A source of endless entertainment.
And a great book.
A source of endless entertainment. You know, the 2012 campaign, and I'll answer this question by talking about the book, which is what I'm here to do, but I will answer the question. You know, we write a lot about Bill Clinton in this book. The story of the courtship of Bill Clinton by Barack Obama's team is quite an extraordinary thing. You know, the two of them. You know, we talked about Game Change in some ways as being the story of the love story of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. These two candidates who met each other, liked each other, and then tried to kill each other for the Democratic nomination, and then eventually ended up married. You know, as politically speaking, at the end of 2008, which is, of course, the way that all great love stories go. This race, you saw 3 years of President Obama and President Clinton really almost not talking at all. Not President Clinton desperate to kind of get back in and have his advice heard. President Obama not really wanting to hear it, not because he felt, I think, any grudge about 2008, but mainly because he didn't feel like he needed President Clinton. And then you find yourself in the fall of 2011, where, when we started this conversation, the president's low ebb politically. And just, again, one sign of how desperate the president's team was they were willing to think about changing out vice president. Another was they were willing to start kissing up to Bill Clinton. And the beginning of that courtship we report about in the book began with a golf game. And it's funny, somebody from Golf Digest wrote a story the other day about 13 seminal moments of golf in Double Down. And Mark and I had no idea we were writing a book about golf, but apparently this book is really just a book about golf, so any of you who are golfers, you'll enjoy it. The two of them met at Andrews Air Force Base, President Clinton, President Obama. They have very different attitudes towards golf. President Obama is very Obaman in his attitude towards golf. He's very disciplined. He wants to get up and down. He plays a lot of golf. He likes to play 2.5 hours, maybe 3 on the course. He's got a tight schedule. He's President of the United States. He's got to get back to work. Wants to play the game, get off the course, go back to work. President Clinton has a different attitude towards golf. President Clinton, as you know, is a retiree, and so his attitude towards a game, you know, he's always been famous for mulligans. He takes a lot of them now. He almost doubles, I think, the number of strokes he takes with all the mulligans. And he also uses the golf course as an opportunity for exposition and persuasion and litigation and other things. They did not get through 18 holes, and they played way more than 3 hours. President Obama left the course kind of shaking his head, and one of his aides came up to him and said, you know, so how'd that go? How'd you like President Clinton? He said, I like him in doses. But from there, they kind of got closer and closer over the course of the campaign. You know, everybody remembers Bill Clinton's speech in Charlotte. It was a big thing for President Obama to give him that night. Again, a sign of President Obama's sense of need. But again, kind of dissing Joe Biden by taking that night away from him and giving to President Clinton. President Obama had heard President Clinton give speeches to donors that really blew President Obama away. Like, he had never heard President Clinton talk about him the way that President Clinton had started to talk about him, his record, very wonky, very passionate. So he ended up, you know, giving him that the ability to speak in Charlotte. In September, after the 47% video came out and Governor Romney was really scraping along and President Obama was seeming to be opening up a big lead, which then got shrunk by the Denver debate, but there was that period in September when it looked like it was going to be a runaway, a friend of President Clinton's asked him what he thought about Governor Romney. And he said, I like him, he's a really nice guy, but I think he's in the wrong line of work. He should not be speaking to people in public. And then the same person asked him, you know, what do you think about President Obama and how well he's doing? And President Clinton said this thing. I'm not a romance scholar, but I learned the Italian for this because I had to be able to say it in certain settings where people were really sensitive. So and the Italian for it is più fortunato di un cane con due cazzi. That's the Italian for what President Clinton said. He said it in English, though, and I think this group could probably tolerate hearing it in the English. The English is, he's luckier than a dog with two dicks. which for President Clinton apparently is like the luckiest thing you could be. You know? I've never really totally understood why a two-dick dog would be so great, but I guess. You know, by the end of the campaign, President Clinton, you know, campaigned like crazy for President Obama while President Obama was tied down with the storm. And then on election night, we report in the book, really kind of as the culmination of this, you know, on election night, Governor Romney called President Obama to concede, and literally the moment that President Obama hung up the phone, the first thing he said was to his campaign manager, Jim Messina, he said, get President Clinton on the phone. And he was the first person he talked to after really getting the concession call. He said he wanted to thank President Clinton for everything he'd done for him over the course of the year. That is kind of unfathomable from the perspective of 2008. It's unfathomable from the perspective of 2011. And these warring families have kind of become one big political family. That's not to say there's not still tension. And obviously, President Clinton said this thing this week that was, or last week, that was kind of problematic for President Obama. But President Obama has done a lot tacitly to help Hillary Clinton, not just make her Secretary of State. There's a lot of Obama infrastructure that's moving behind her very quickly right now. A lot of Obama supporters in the elected officials and other places who have now very publicly switched their support to Secretary Clinton. She stands well poised to inherit his machine and his coalition, which are two of the really lasting achievements that President Obama has had in the political sphere. President Clinton was much enhanced, obviously, by all of this, right? He got to show the world that he still had his fastball after a lot of people thought he had lost it in 2008. And the speech in Charlotte was an extraordinary thing. After that speech, the right track, wrong track numbers moved appreciably. And no one had ever seen anything like that happen before. Like the right track, wrong track numbers on an incumbent president just don't move in the absence of number of people say the country's on the right track versus say the country's on the wrong track. The numbers had not moved for a year and a half, and the economy didn't really change very much. And when the Romney people asked their lead pollster, Neil Newhouse, what accounted for the fact that the right track, wrong track numbers had moved by like 15 points after the conventions, Neil Newhouse said, Clinton. It was one speech. Nobody had ever seen anything like it before. And I think this is coming to the actually answer your question. I think he is feeling his oats now, and he's not like other, you know, ex-presidents. He's not like Jimmy Carter, and he's not like George W. Bush. He wants to be a player, and he's shown to his satisfaction and to a lot of other people's satisfaction that he still is capable of having some game. I think the question for her is how to balance the problem she never balanced in 2008, which was there was, for a year and a half, there was too little Bill Clinton in her campaign, and then there was way too much. And so the problem of how do you find the Goldilocks spot of the right amount of Bill Clinton is the challenge that she'll have to confront. But she was foolish to not employ him more in all of 2007. And I think it was a lot of why he burst forth in kind of unhelpful ways in the early part of 2008. If she can find a way to modulate him and he allows allows himself to be modulated, he could be one of the great assets in American politics, and I think that's the role he wants to play. And I think increasingly she understands that that is what he should be doing for her.
Well, John, I don't want to cut you off, but I'm going to because I want to be sure we get some more questions.
Yes, I've stopped now on Bill Clinton, but we
have time for about two more questions. Pat Patterson, we'll take.
I'm going to do these very fast. We'll do them super quick. Let's go.
If you're handicapping the 2016 election, do you suppose that the Republicans will find you?
I have absolutely no idea. It's going to be the first Republican race in a long time that's wide open. But I think that there is what the Republican Party needs is someone who can fuse the energy of the far right and the grassroots with the electability and sanity of the establishment wing of the party. And someone like Chris Christie is someone who has a conceivable would have the possibility of doing that. Jeb Bush is someone who has a possibility of doing that. There are a lot of talented Republican governors around the country who are conservative but have governed effectively and pragmatically to the satisfaction of the voters in their states, whether that's Scott Walker in Wisconsin or Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. There are people like that. My guess is that, and we could talk about Ted Cruz if you wish, but my guess is that it will not be someone, because the Republican Party has never nominated someone who has represented the far right of their party. It's never happened. I don't think it'll happen this time. I think the Tea Party will be weaker in 2016 than it was in 2012. And even in 2012, they nominated Mitt Romney. So, and I don't think, I think the combination of Senate and too far right will be problematic for some of the people like Senator Cruz and Senator Paul to be able to actually be the nominee in that party.
Well, I may get in trouble with our board of directors if they ever check the internet from my work on Sunday, because I discovered something called William Hill Online Betting Service. And Bobby Jindal is 50-1 odds, and Rick Perry 100-1, and Hillary Clinton is a 2-1 favorite to win the Democratic nomination.
Yes.
Go ahead, you.
What do you think the four most important issues will be in the 2014 midterms? Four most important issues.
Did you say other than Obamacare?
Well,
thank you for taking off the most important issue off the topic. That's unfair. Obamacare, I think Republicans are determined to make Obamacare the most important issue in the 2014 midterms, and certainly the economy and jobs are always super important. But, you know, congressional races are still, by and large, the question. I mean, it's an open question whether the 2014 midterms will be nationalized or not. Republicans will try to nationalize those races around those big issues, around the notion that President Obama can't get anything done, and he's governing too far from the left. Obamacare's been a failure, and the economy still sucks. That's what they will try to nationalize the elections around, but congressional elections are not always nationalized. And, you know, 2010 was a nationalized Republican, it was a nationalized midterm. 2006 was not really a nationalized midterm, and neither was 2002. So the question of whether it becomes big national issues drive those midterm elections, or whether they are driven much more by district and state by state issues, I think is still an open question at this point.
What do you think the potential is for this multitude of scandals to bear fruit negatively against the administration?
Which multitude of scandals are those?
The multitude of the Obama administration.
What scandals are you referring to?
How long do you have?
Well, what?
I just name.
Fast and Furious. I could go on.
Well, we could have a longer conversation later about whether those are scandals or not. I would take issue with a couple of them. If that's the list that we're bringing, none of those things will have anything to do with the president's pot. With none of them will ever come to fruition because they're all ridiculous issues.
We'll take the last question. Where is it? In the very back. Is that you, Lynn? Yep.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Actually, let me just go back and say this. I want to say this. Oh, they're all serious issues, but none of them are scandals, and none of them, I think, will ultimately be drawn back to President Obama. You know, the IRS thing is a huge problem, but the evidence that we currently have, it's a localized problem. Benghazi was a horrific foreign policy failure, but to the best of my knowledge, I think Republicans are insane to keep talking about it. It's not a political issue that cuts any ice with almost any Americans except for people on the far right. And that those people care about it a lot, I understand. And it was a massive failure of American of diplomatic security. But do I think that has a political effect on President Obama going forward? I do not. It has not so far, and I don't think it will tomorrow.
Lynn, you got the last question.
President Clinton has formed a friendship with the Bush family. Primarily the senior president. How's that going to play into Hillary's candidacy?
I don't imagine it will play very much. You know, the Bushes have been very, particularly George W. Bush. You know, George Herbert Walker Bush is more or less out of commission, and George W. Bush has exhibited no interest, as far as I can see, in being involved in national politics anymore, you know, whether it's on let alone in Democratic politics, but he's not really even interested in being involved in Republican politics. I can't imagine him having any kind of an active role in 2016 on either side of the aisle. There's just been no evidence whatsoever that he has any hunger for that or appetite for it. It's kind of he's behaving like an incredibly normal human being. I say that with admiration. Like, you know, he likes the guy. I think that it's amazing how disciplined he's been about saying, I'm done with public life. Not public life entirely, but with American political public life. And I can't imagine why that would change.
John, I want to thank you very much for being
thank
with
you,
us.
Sir.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.